Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off-limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey, everybody. I have a disturbing one today. You know, as usual. The subject today is immigration and our southern border and children and families and who we are. We are, of course, a country of immigrants. Let me tell you how much as a nation we value immigrants. In the entire history of the United States of America, in our 238 years as a republic, we have not had a president, a vice president, or a member of the cabinet who did not descend from immigrants. Until this year. It took till just a few weeks ago when Deb Haaland, a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe, took her oath as Secretary of the Interior. Must be nice, Deb Haaland, being indigenous. Your forefathers didn't have to go through immigration like mine did. Sweet. My grandparents were immigrants. My mom's side came from Russia. My dad's from Germany. All about the same time, right? Right at the turn of the century, about 1900. They came into New York Harbor, passing the Statue of Liberty with Emma Lazarus's poem on its pedestal, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." I gotta admit, that's a nice welcome. Now, all my grandparents were Jews. Not particularly popular in some circles in this country at the time. Even now, the guy who wore the Camp Auschwitz shirt at the Capitol, at the riot in January, clearly not a fan. Now, he might be surprised, for example, that Michael Landon, Little Joe on Bonanza, and Charles Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie, Jew. "Really?" says the guy in Camp Auschwitz shirt. "I like that show. Maybe these Jews aren't so bad after all." My grandpa, Simon Kunst, who came at the age of 16 from Russia, speaking no English, built a quilting factory. My grandfather, Otto Franken, from Germany, drove a truck from Washington Heights on the top of Manhattan to Maine and picked up lobsters and brought them back down to fancy schmancy restaurants in the theater district. I never knew Otto. The kids in Washington Heights loved him. He died of tuberculosis in 1924 at the age of 48. They got on a boat, crossed the ocean, speaking no English, to make a life here in America. That's a lot of stories. It's all our stories, basically, except Deb Haaland's, and except those coming from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. They're walking. And when they get to the border, it's a much different case right now for these kids, certainly for their parents. They speak a different language. So did my grandparents. They have nothing or next to nothing. So did my grandparents. They're fleeing corruption and violence and persecution. So did my grandparents. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." My guest is Ali Noorani. Ali is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. He's been at this for almost 20 years, and he is exactly the right guy to talk to about all of this. And I hope you get as much out of listening to this as I got from talking with him. We've got a disturbing one today, you know, as usual. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When it comes to picking the perfect treats for your dog, Stewart makes the choice easy by keeping it real. Real ingredients, real nutrients, real benefits. Stewart dog treats are free from additives, corn, soy, wheat, and grains. Plus, they're freeze-dried to lock in all the great nutrition and natural flavor your furry friend deserves. Stewart freeze-dried dog treats. Big, tail-wagging nutritional benefits. Available on Amazon.com today.
Well, we met yesterday on the phone. Our mutual friend, Maria Teresa Kumar, put us together. I told her I wanted to do a podcast on the border situation today and immigration writ large, in a way. And Maria Teresa said, you were the single best person I should talk to.
You know, I have to send her that Venmo of $50 now, but she is hands down one of just my favorite people. And I know we've learned a lot from her over the years, and she's just done such great work at Voto Latino.
Yeah, well, I don't necessarily trust her judgment. but nevertheless, she gave me your number, and you and I spoke yesterday about this is an extremely complex, difficult, and emotional topic. And I have to say, we spoke for almost an hour, and she made the right call. We had a great discussion, and I certainly learned a lot. And I think we've arrived at kind of a shape for this discussion, thanks to you, I think.
Thank you. Well, let's see how. Come let's on. See what you say in about an hour, right?
Didn't I contribute to shaping it?
I'm just following your lead here.
Yeah, well, part of following my lead is when I say, give you a compliment, you give me one back. That's following. That's called following. Okay, look. we decided to start in 2013, right?
Yep.
We could go from the first immigration thing in our history, the pilgrims, but let's start at 2013 because I was on the Judiciary Committee then. At that time, we were writing a comprehensive immigration bill that passed the Senate with 68 votes, with the leadership of the Gang of Eight, Schumer, Durbin, Bennett, and Menendez on the Democratic side, and McCain, Flake, Lindsey Graham, and Marco Rubio on the Republican side. And the bill created a path to citizenship for, what, about 10 to 12 million undocumented immigrants? Is that right?
That is correct, yep. It was a great bill, I mean.
Yeah, it was a great bill and had the support of labor and had the support of agriculture and of the Chamber of Commerce. It had wide support, also, most importantly, with the American people. And then what the hell happened? And what the hell happened was the Tea Party, right?
Yeah, and it was very much kind of the implementation of kind of the Tea Party kind of way of thinking and really that Eric Cantor race in a primary in June of 2014, where, you know, in the days and the weeks up to that election, you had Paul Ryan, who was then chair of, I think, budget, Luis Gutierrez, mm-hmm. Democrat from Illinois, from Chicago. The two of them were working together to whip votes. And their thinking was Eric Cantor gets through his primary. The next day we walk into Speaker Boehner's office and we lay out the votes and we pass this bill. And, you know, the bottom fell
out. Eric Cantor was in the leadership. What was he, like majority whip?
He was. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So he's got this primary in Southern Virginia, and everybody assumes, okay, he's a powerful guy. District wants a powerful guy to represent them in the House. He's the majority whip, and boom, he loses. And the guy who beat him was just very anti-immigrant. That was his whole thing.
But it was a combination of things. It was, yes, he ran on an anti-immigrant platform. And the interesting part about it was that Cantor was never really seen as somebody as pro-immigrant. He had occasionally said something positive about Dreamers, but he was not, we didn't see him as a yes vote by any means. But Cantor was also, you know, a politician who just took his district for granted. And, you know, he was in D.C. the day of the primary. He wasn't even bothering to campaign. So it was just a combination of a very powerful anti-immigrant message and a candidate or an incumbent who, frankly, had written off his voters.
And at the time, I remember Laura Ingraham and other of these right-wing folks really hitting Cantor on this, right?
Absolutely. It was certainly the leading message. And, you know, because at that point, you had the Senate bill being considered in the House. You also had the beginning of a flow of unaccompanied children from Central America. So it was kind of a foreshadowing of kind of what we're seeing here, you know, today in terms of a Republican Party dragged far to the right and migration flows from Central America. But, you know, I don't want to jump ahead on the timeline.
Okay. Well, anyway, he loses in the primary and bam, it's over, right? This is not going to keep pass in the House. And Marco Rubio, who had been part of the Gang of Eight, one of the four Republicans, after that, I remember talking to him and he'd go like, well, look, no, I'm not going to be for comprehensive immigration reform because it's not politically possible, you know? And I went, huh? You were one of the Gang of Eight. And he goes, no, it's just not politically possible. And frankly, I would lose if I were for it. And this was in the Senate and in the House or in Congress, a politically respectable stance or excuse. You go like, oh, no, I'm for this thing, but I can't be for it because I'd lose. This isn't just Republicans, this is both. That's a perfectly legitimate excuse saying like, oh, no, I'm for it, but I can't be for it.
And, you know, it just feels like oftentimes, you know, again, Republicans and Democrats, there's kind of a hesitancy to kind of put in the work to explain an issue and to bring along voters and saying, okay, this is where we need to go. And it just these days, and especially in the immigration space, you know, we're always talking to Republicans and they're saying, yeah, we're with you, but I can't get there publicly. And, you know, there's just a real hesitancy or refusal to do the work often.
And my understanding is if you go to the American people and you say, do you think we should do comprehensive immigration reform and give a path to people who aren't documented now to citizenship? They will say, oh, yeah, that's the reasonable, that's the smartest thing to do.
And that's across both Democratic and even Republican voters. And even when you get to the subsegments of Republican voters, such as, you know, white evangelical Christians, people have come to appreciate the contributions of the undocumented and see that, you know, they have earned the opportunity to become United States citizens. But so much, particularly within the Republican Party, of the debate is dominated by this far right wing that's small but incredibly loud. And that's what shapes the perception of a lot of these members.
And you talk about this a lot. You talk about that those of us who favor immigration and immigration reform have to understand the fear and even prejudices of folks who are against it and understand that and address it. Is that a fair way of saying what you're saying? Or?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In fact, in 2017, I published a book called There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Deal with Prejudice That Comes with American Immigration. And what I did in the book is really tried to lay out the conservative faith perspective, the law enforcement perspective, the business perspective, of all from a conservative vantage point, of why people have, yes, questions, but ultimately they want to be in the right right place on immigration. And what we found is that those fears boil down to culture, security, and the economy.
I'll let you do it, but the culture part would be that they worry that, hey, we like being a white town, and I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, it's actually even a little bit more than that. And the way that, you know, I would boil it down is that the question they'll have is, are immigrants, are they integrating, or are they isolating? You know, are they learning English, or do I have to always press one for English? From a security perspective, the question is, are immigrants, are they threats or protectors? Are they here to do harm or ultimately protect Americans and American values? And then from an economic perspective, the question is, are immigrants, are they givers or takers? Are they contributing to the economy? Or are they taking something from me? And we're always trying to figure out, okay, how do we answer those questions that are kind of underneath the ugliness of this debate?
And the ugliness of the debate gets a lot of voice. It gets a lot of voice in social media. It gets a lot of voice on places like Fox and Newsmax and OANN and talk radio, right?
Exactly. And, you know, kind of going back to that 2013 bill that you helped pass in the Senate and then 2014 in the House, you know, if Boehner had kind of put his foot on the gas before the Cantor primary and gotten that bill through, I could make an argument that Donald Trump would have had a much harder time, you know, winning that primary and much less the general election, because the issue would have been kind of taken off the table and people would have seen that, okay, the world did not end because, you know, 11 million people are no longer living in the shadows. So in some ways, you know, Boehner, his lack of aggressiveness on the issue, it really created a vacuum into which Trump stepped.
Yeah, and I remember that. We passed that in 13. I'm thinking, okay, good. Now the House will take it up and we'll pass that. And, you know, Chamber of Commerce is for it. Agriculture is for it. Unions are for it. Pretty much everyone's for it. So let's do this. And I did not understand why they didn't. And then he waited until Cantor loss. And then, boom, it just blew up and was over. Now, so we don't get it. We don't get the bill. And so we've done 2013, the hope, 2014, the Tea Party and it falling apart. Let's go to 2015 and Syria.
So what happens in 2015, or actually what begins in 2013, is the civil war in Syria.
There's a drought, right? This is a climate change story in a way.
It's amazing that we don't remember what was actually the trigger for all of this.
Yeah, there was a huge drought in Syria, and so everybody kind of had to move into the cities, and things started going south.
And Assad, you know, he clamps down. And what's happened, you know, since then, what began it really in 2015 is that, you know, millions of Syrians have been displaced either internally or moving into Europe. But what happened is that the pictures and the news of hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees trying to make it to Europe in order to gain asylum is that reshaped in a very negative way, to say the least, the immigration debate in the U.S. And, you know, Trump, when he comes down the golden escalator in June of 2016, we all remember that he talks about, claiming that Mexico is sending rapists. But what's happening across
this the country, is actually in 15, isn't it? I mean, it is in 15.
And then what's happening across the country is that you have local press, you know, fixated on these Syrian refugee pictures and stories. And then on December 7th, 2015, Trump says that as president, he will ban Muslim immigration to the United States. So there's this conflation of Syrian refugees, Islam, immigration from Mexico and Central America, all into one really toxic narrative that Trump ultimately weaponizes in a way that was very successful for him.
This is also a humanitarian catastrophe, but really also to our everlasting shame. We did not take the number of refugees from Syria that anywhere near what we should have. You know, I remember debating this in Judiciary, and Dick Durbin was a leader in this, and Jeff Sessions was just awful on this. And of course, you know, Trump perpetrated this lie that, you know, oh, we don't know who these people are. No, we vetted them for 2 years, and I'm still just very angry about that. You know, just Trump came to Minnesota like 2 days before the election and just demagogued this, attacked this Somalis in Minnesota, the Somali Minnesotans in Minnesota, 2 days before the campaign. And this was sick. This was just sick, and it allowed him to win.
It really did. It tapped into the cultural fear that people had, the security fear, and the economic fear. By scapegoating immigrants and refugees, the overwhelming majority of whom were never going to set foot in the United States. And it just reshaped, you know, all, up to that point, you know, look, the immigration debate was already difficult, but he was able to create this mandate to really do everything that he could over the course of his administration to end immigration to the United States as we know it.
So he gets elected. So that takes us, he gets elected in 16, and that takes us to, like, let's do 2017 to 2020, the Trump administration, and their approach to our southern border, and to Stephen Miller and Jeff Sessions.
This is turning into a very dark podcast, Al. We'll have to, you know, get cheery at the end here.
This is a dark, dark period, yep. But we'll try. We'll try to, on here on the podcast, we try to laugh in the face of horror and manage to do it sometimes. So let's see if I can say something funny about Jeff Sessions and Stephen Miller. Oh, man.
So Jeff Sessions, right? So the thing about Jeff Sessions as Attorney General and then Stephen Miller as kind of the point immigration person for the Trump administration.
And Miller had worked for Sessions in the Senate, so he's a Sessions guy.
Exactly. Yeah. And the thing is that they were able to embed political appointees, whether it was from the Sessions Senate office or other very, very anti-immigrant Republican offices across the executive branch. So by having the right staff in place who really knew and understood the system, they were able to pull every single lever they could to, over the course of 4 years, put in place, I think, over 1,100 changes to immigration policy. I would say like five of them I've heard were maybe could be seen as positive. So they put the people in place that could do the most damage. The interesting part about this, and, you know, we often forget about, you know, the public reaction to, you know, the initial travel bans. And we think about, obviously, the protests at the airports and the lawsuits by ACLU and others. But you also had organizations like, you know, the Mormon Church, the Southern Baptists, the Catholic Church, evangelicals, also pushing back on the Trump administration in those early days. And they were making a case that as a nation, we believe in religious liberty. And there's no way we should be standing for the discrimination or keeping people out of the country based on their religion. So in those first, you know, 3 to 6 months of 2017, we began to see kind of some hope of, okay, how do we create a different sort of conversation in conservative America that began to play out as those years went by.
And that's what started. But this administration, to me, their response to immigration became, let's just be cruel. Let's be cruel. Let's make it not just to people crossing the border or wanting to cross the border and then separating children and all that kind of terrible stuff. But also, let's make every undocumented immigrant and their children who are citizens, let's make them really scared. Let's really do a number on them. Let's do a number on American citizens in elementary school and make them scared every day that when they get home, their parents will be gone.
And you saw this playing out, you know, in communities across the country. And I think one of the stories that always sticks with me is, you know, it was a small town, I think, in Ohio, where nobody knew that you know, their favorite Mexican restaurant owned by an immigrant who was a volunteer with a, you know, a local fundraisers, et cetera, that is, he was undocumented. In fact, I think it was also eventually shown that his wife voted for Trump. But people, they did not realize how close this issue was to their lives. And they slowly began to understand the kind of the terror that Trump was instilling within the immigrant community.
Oh, and look, in Minnesota, dairy farmers.
Yeah.
I remember in 13, when we were doing this bill, I made the point, remember, there were like seasonal stuff on agricultural workers, like you could come seasonally. And I made the point in committee that cows need to be milked every day. You know, if you're a cow, you can't like not be milked for 6 months. It would hurt. And so I educated a number of my colleagues on the Judiciary Committee that cows need to be milked every day. Anyway, we need these workers. We need these workers. And this is why the ag community was so for the 13 bill and why they were so upset during this part of the Trump administration about this.
We do a lot of work in Idaho with dairy farmers there, and they were some of the first folks out of the gates in 2017, standing up for their immigrant workforce, standing up for refugees in Idaho, because, you know, they worked shoulder to shoulder with this community, you know, practically 24 hours a day to make sure those cows are milked, you know, twice a day.
By the way, Minnesota, we don't take favorably to Idaho dairy farmers. And that, I know that was an industry that was growing, and thanks to these horrible immigration policies of this administration, thank God we hurt that industry in Idaho. We dairy farmers in Minnesota. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ali Narani, the Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream, are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
We're back with Ali Narani, Executive Director of the National Immigration Forum. So let's talk, culture, security, givers or takers. So that speaks to givers or takers, because the guy who owns the most popular restaurant in town, and that is the case in big parts of Minnesota and red areas of Minnesota, the most popular restaurant in town is a Mexican restaurant. And the, you know, I just had Heather McGee on. You know Heather. Mm-hmm. And she's written a book called The Sum of Us about how, and this is part of this, that whites in America are sold by the oligarchy, that this is a zero-sum game, our economy, and that anything that helps people of color hurts them. And it's not true. It's just not true. And we all do better when we all do better is what Paul Wellstone said. But they are being sold this. So they're being sold that But that's not true. And in her book, The Sum of Us, we see all kinds of communities where you see this all over the United States, where small towns have been revived by immigration. What was that town in Iowa?
Storm Lake, Iowa. It's roughly about 10,000 people. It is one of the few rural towns in Iowa that has grown, and it's growing because of a growth in the Hispanic population, from working age adults and now to children. So there are dozens of languages spoken in their school system, not just obviously Spanish, but they have a large and diverse refugee population. In fact, I was just reading this the other day. Governor Ray of Iowa, back in the late 70s, made the case for the group resettlement of the Thai Dom, which were a group of ethnic Vietnamese who were displaced after the Vietnam War. And he said he had heard about this community, and he brought 1,400 of them to Iowa, and they ended up living either in Storm Lake or in Des Moines, and just kind of created this rich cultural diversity within rural Iowa that obviously Steve King, born in Storm Lake, by the way, never saw the value in.
Okay, let's get to the border. Let's get to the border and what's been going on since Trump came in. What's been going on the border? Let's go to Mexico. Let's go to Central America. Let's go to, Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, and also to what's going on in Mexico and what Trump, what they did during their 4 years, where we are now, and what the future will look like. That's kind of a lot to bite off, but this is what I think people are focused on now.
Yep. So in 2017, late 2017, the Trump administration started to secretly test a program in El Paso. And that program was the separation of children from the parent who brought them to the border to seek asylum. And the legal kind of mechanism that they used is that they would criminally charge the adult with entering with crossing the border without inspection. And once an adult is criminally charged, their child is removed from them. So what happened in 2017, and this was then scaled all across the border across 2018, is that you saw over time thousands of families separated by the Trump administration, and parents being criminally charged and their children being kicked into, the federal bureaucracy. And then really trying to, there's a lot of work to be done to try to reconnect the child to the parent. So that was in 2017, and then really, really took over the public's attention in the spring and summer of 2018, when we saw the pictures and we heard those recordings of children, sobbing because, they had been taken from their parents.
Yeah, I can't think of anything crueler. I can't think of the trauma that these parents and these kids will live with for the rest of their lives. These children, I mean, as a father and as a grandfather, this is just, I mean, it's maddening and heartbreaking. I can't express it, the cruelty of this. And that was what they were doing. Let's be cruel. And the cruelty will tamp down the number that want to cross, right?
Exactly. I mean, this was a Jeff Sessions and Stephen Miller strategy to make life as miserable as possible through these cruel policies so that nobody would ever want to come to the United States again. It's hard to believe that we did this as a country.
But we did. And we elected Donald Trump as a country, and he picked Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and he picked Stephen Miller basically in charge of our immigration policy. Okay, so what's going on here now? Let's go to Central America. These three countries are failing in different ways, okay? Is that fair to say?
Fair to say.
Talk a little bit about these countries, because we're talking about Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Now, who are the leaders of these countries? Who are the people who run these countries? Who are the elites? And, talk about the drug cartels and now gangs and smuggle people? Give us an overview of all that so we can understand it.
Sure. So, you know, the U.S. relationship with these Central American countries, that they're also referred to as kind of the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, really, I think in modern time dates back to the 1980s, where you saw communism starting to, you know, kind of try to make its way across, you know, Nicaragua and other places, where Honduras was used as kind of a landing pad for American efforts to push communism out of the region. And what happens as a result is that, you know, these societies are really destabilized by kind of, you know, what you could argue would be political meddling by the U.S. So that takes place in the 80s. And then in the 90s, they're trying to get back up on their feet. The economies are not clicking. And who steps into the vacuum again is an elite class that, you know, is running some of the big energy companies, the big kind of agricultural companies. You have a ruling class in terms of leading the governments that are increasingly corrupt. And then you have the cartels, drug traffickers, that once the U.S. started to really kind of make drug trafficking from South America into Miami more and more difficult, or South Florida more and more difficult, they moved their routes from South America or Colombia to South Florida to become Colombia into Central America and then to Mexico into the U.S. So then you had over time these Central American countries really being kind of a highway for drug traffickers that, you know, also destabilized the nations and just made it increasingly difficult for, you know, a normal person to be able to make a living, raise a family in a safe fashion. So, you know, you kind of put all those pieces together and you have societies that are just, they're not stable and people are looking for a place to go. And lo and behold, they can literally walk to the United States.
These cartels and these drug traffickers are also beginning to tell people from those three countries, one, we may kill you, but instead of killing you, we will take money from you to get you up to the United States, to take you up.
Exactly. I mean, I was, over the last few days, I talked to a lot of folks who are kind of doing their work these days in the region and also at the border. And in 2019, I did a couple trips to Honduras as well. And what happens is that, you know, let's say, you know, you're a father who owns a taxi, right? So you have to pay rent to the local gang in order to operate your business as a taxi. If you can't pay that rent, they will kill you. So then you have to pay a different smuggler to get you and your family to the U.S.-Mexico border. And then once you reach the border, you have to pay a different cartel to actually have the privilege, if you will, to present to the U.S. Border Protection to ask for asylum. So the cartels and organized crime, they have really monetized the movement of people that they have played a large role in kind of creating by the violence and the impunity and the corruption in Central America to begin with.
Okay, and all this raises the question eventually in the overview of the problem that we have now, which is how do you address that? That seems like a very, very, very big problem. Tell me about the president of Honduras and his brother.
So President Juan Orlando Hernandez, he was elected, I want to say, in 2015. So there's a couple things that happened really in 2015 and 16 that I think are important in terms of lessons for rooting out corruption. One is you had the Organization of American States deploy a mission to Honduras to conduct investigations into government leaders. They, in fact, ended up prosecuting the wife of a former president for corruption. The second thing that happened in 2016 was that there was a purge of the Honduran National Police so that thousands of Honduran National Police officers from leadership to rank and file were purged from the force in order to, in essence, rebuild confidence. Those programs started to backslide over the Trump administration because they started to take funding away and they stopped applying political pressure.
So the Trump administration had a negative effect on these countries in terms of our goals of tamping down corruption, et cetera.
Precisely, because, you know, you had Trump threatening to and then, you know, pulling foreign aid. because he believed that they were not doing enough to stop migration, when in reality, the foreign aid was moving programs in the civil sector to actually stamp out and reduce corruption. So he, you know, by threatening and then pulling money, he actually stopped the progress that was being made.
Sounds like Trump didn't do his due diligence.
I know that's
surprising. That was a joke. That was a joke. Okay. So talk about like Trump and Mexico, and, you know, Mexico is a big part of those people have to come through Mexico, right?
Yep. So Trump is elected at the same time or just before López Obrador is elected, the new Mexican president. So, you know, Trump over the course of his campaign is obviously scapegoating Mexico and Mexicans, gets into office. One of the first things that he says he wants to do is to renegotiate NAFTA. And there begins this process to negotiate, you know, a new NAFTA or the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA. So AMLO is under political pressure in Mexico to make sure that that negotiation goes well, because his business, you know, the Mexican economy relies on, you know, trade with the U.S. to a large degree. And he's under pressure from the Trump administration to stop migration from Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border. So what AMLO ends up doing over the course of the Trump administration is that he deploys the federal army to the Mexico's southern border. Mexico doesn't have a border patrol per se. They just have a military. So these are not individuals trained in migration management. These are individuals trained for military actions. Mexico also does not have a, you know, well-functioning asylum or immigration system. But again, AMLO needs to kind of show Trump that he's clamping down. AMLO is President López Obrador of Mexico. I'm sorry.
Okay, yes. Okay. Thank you. I did that on behalf of my audience and also me. Okay, good. Keep going.
So in Mexico, you start seeing pictures of migrants from Central America stopped at the border, oftentimes violent clashes between Mexican military police and migrants. But then eventually, you know, the cartels and the smugglers, they figure out a way around, right? Because that's kind of
their job.
Their job. They're good at it.
They're conscientious. They do their job.
Right. So they start to get people to the border, you know, to the U.S.-Mexico border, get them around the Mexican military. And then, you know, once they reach the U.S.-Mexico border, then Trump is in this position of, okay, how do I make sure that I keep people out full stop? And that's when you see the Remain in Mexico or the Migrant Protection Protocol program in early 2019.
Explain that.
So the child separation program, that was halted in the summer of 2018 because of outcry from the public, but also from people like Franklin Graham and others on Trump's evangelical advisory board, who just said, you know what, we cannot be doing this as a country. So 6 months later, they come up with this idea that people must wait in Mexico, remain in Mexico, while their asylum cases are moving forward in the United States. Between 2019 and the end of the administration, we saw over 71,000 families pushed back into Mexico while their asylum cases were moving through the immigration court system.
So these people are now pushed back. They're in Mexico. They hire people to get them into the United States by going toward the east.
So there's a couple things that happen. So if we started seeing people who were detained or pushed back in San Diego, Tijuana, they would start to move east to the Arizona desert. You saw people in Brownsville, South Texas, same thing. They would move kind of northwest, if you will, again, to try to find other places. But the big thing here, Al, is that what would happen is that the lie that the migrant was sold back in Honduras in 2019 was that you bring your child to the border and you can get in and be able to request asylum. I mean, I met with a coffee farmer in the highlands of Honduras. He told me that, you know, he paid a smuggler $6,000, had to mortgage his house, sell his car to make this journey. Took him and his daughter, I think, over a month. Gets to the border, and just realizes that that was a lie. And there is no way to enter the U.S. and that he would have to remain in Mexico while his case was being processed. I met another person in the same area who did the same thing, and then he was kidnapped. He and his family were kidnapped while they were waiting in Mexico. He decided eventually, I got to scrape together the money and get myself back to Honduras, because it's not fun being kidnapped by the cartels in Matamoros.
So he had to get the money to pay them off.
I think his sister ended up paying $3,000. Yep.
Okay. So this is just nightmare after nightmare for these folks.
Precisely.
Including people dying in the desert when these coyotes take them across in places that are really hot and dry.
Right. And you know, you have to really thank the organizations that are working in the desert of Arizona and elsewhere who are, you know, trying to help these migrants just by giving them water and shelter when they get lost. And really they're on their last legs. And some of the, you know, these folks are just doing God's work in that space. But, you know, the coyotes just, you know, once trouble comes, the coyotes just split and folks are left to their own devices.
Okay. So now, where are we now? We have a new administration. This is such a conundrum on what to do. And there are very many different views of what to do here. The president has put Vice President Harris in charge of this, which is a tough assignment, for mm-hmm. God's sakes, right? Tell me what they are considering, what choices they are faced with, what they have to do, what the political pressures are, because there are within the Democratic Party, there are different views. And let me know what your thoughts are on all of this.
Well, the big factor here is that once COVID-19 hit, then the border really got shut down. And in March of last year, just about a year ago, President Trump instituted Title 42 restrictions on movement across the border. And what that means is that under Title 42, which is part of the CDC, is that because there is a public health crisis, to shorthand it, nobody is allowed to cross the border, which means that now the Biden administration is under incredible pressure, not just to reverse the over 1,000 immigration policies that Sessions, Miller, and company put into place, but also to reopen the border and reopen our asylum system. They cannot do that overnight. And that's the challenge that they're in. So these days, we're starting to see this spike in the flow of unaccompanied children to present at the border to ask for asylum. Those children are coming from a couple of different places. One is there continues to be a seasonal flow of children from Central America to the border to ask for asylum. We've seen this in 2014. We saw it in 2019.
How old are these kids?
You know, what I saw this morning was that the majority of the kids are, you know, early teens, like 13 to like 15, 16. But you still have a significant number, you know, 20 to 30% who are, you know, younger, like 6 to 10. And then you still have numbers, you know, a handful who are even younger than that in terms of toddlers or, you know, four-year-olds or 5-year-olds.
And how are they getting there? Are they getting there with parents or family, or are they just getting there with these smugglers?
Yeah, in a couple different ways. One is, yes, they're still trafficking, traffic created by smugglers who are bringing children on their own. But then you also have parents who will come to the border, realize that the parents cannot cross the border, and then parents are making this very awful, difficult decision to send their children across on their own because they realize that that's the only way they can get their kids to safety. And then you have a third population that's just been stranded on the border for months who are just at the end of, you know, they're struggling to survive. And now that they see that the Biden administration has lifted those Title 42 restrictions only for unaccompanied children and families with young children, that they're deciding to send their children along on their own. Title 42 remains in place for families with older children as well as adults. So the border is nowhere near open, which is what many on the left would like to see the Biden administration do.
Okay, so how feasible is that? I mean, it seems like there are only bad choices here in many ways.
There are a lot of bad choices, and I think there are a lot of really good and important choices. We think that the Biden administration needs to establish the infrastructure, the logistics, and the processes to reopen our asylum system and our border. So what does that look like? It means that in terms of infrastructure, make sure that there are the facilities in place, whether it's military bases, soft-sided tents, or otherwise. Let's make sure that whether it's Customs and Border Protection or Health and Human Services, that people have a place to go in order to begin their process once they get to the border. In terms of the logistics, they've got to do a much better job of making sure that DHS, Department of Homeland Security, is talking to Health and Human Services, because those are the two key agencies in terms of initial processing. And then third, in terms of processing, it means that Department of Justice needs to make sure that their immigration judges are available to hear cases, that their asylum officers ready to conduct interviews. So it's a complicated problem that, yes, requires a complicated solution. But at the end of the day, none of this is new. It just takes time to stand up these systems and to then move people through the process.
That's part of why I'm saying they're mainly bad choices now, because of this time.
Yep.
Because between now and when you do that, invest those resources and get everything you said up, there's time. And between now and then, what do you do? And what are the politics of that? And that is really, really difficult stuff, right?
It really is, because, I mean, I think Biden has done the right thing morally and politically by saying, we're going to protect children. But then you walk into the situation where you now have pictures of kids, you know, in these pods. Well, under the Trump administration, those were kids in cages. They're two very different things because there's two very different intentions. Remember, you said earlier, the Trump administration, their intention was to treat kids and families with extreme cruelty. The intention of the Biden administration is to treat kids and families with compassion, but the pictures still look the same, which creates this political pinch point, both from the left and the right. You know, beyond that, the question of what are the numbers? And I think the American public, for a country that's over 300 million people, we have this amazing ability to, you know, lose our minds over, 10,000 kids who are looking for protection. So there's this level setting of expectations, and what does it really mean for the country, and, you know, what's the benefit to the country?
How can we make this investment in doing the stuff you are saying we need to do? I mean, and how can we do all this stuff at the same time? You know, what we're talking about is addressing the corruption in Central America, probably addressing corruption in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking about building the infrastructure so that you can house people humanely. You're also talking about our asylum process, which is the backlogs are huge. Who gets to go before a judge, and who gets a lawyer to go before a judge? Are there actually, I've heard of children who don't speak English, of course, going before an immigration judge for asylum. And maybe they get an interpreter, but, you know, you're not an immigration lawyer, but certainly a six-year-old kid isn't. This is insanely dysfunctional, right?
And it kind of goes back to, like, why that 2013-2014 opportunity that we lost is so critical, because that would have created the legal channels for people to migrate from Central America to the U.S. So they would never have to make the case for asylum. They could have applied for a work visa, which they much rather would have done. So how do you address the short-term problem that we face today? At the border, let's make sure that Secretary Mayorkas, Secretary Becerra, DHS, HHS are putting the people and the infrastructure in place, that they are collaborating with nonprofit organizations at the border and across the country, and churches across the country, to make sure that these kids and families have a place to go that's safe and that they can get access to immigration attorneys. We did this in 2014. We did this in 2019. We can do that again now at the border. In the midterm and the long term, I think that the deployment of the vice president to really engage Central America and Mexico in the diplomacy and, you know, the arm twisting, if you will, that's necessary to start to root out corruption. But then let's rebuild those dollars so that non-governmental organizations in Central America can once again do the work that's necessary to stem violence, corruption, and poverty.
So this is going to take time, but it's an investment, you know, that we haven't made. How long, what is the backlog on in terms of if you're waiting for asylum? How long does it take? How many people are there in line?
In the total immigration court system, I believe the backlog these days is well over a million cases. An asylum case has several steps to it. So you have your initial credible fear interview. You pass that interview, then you kind of get kicked into the immigration courts and you start that process. That process can take months, if not typically 2 or 3 years at least, in order to get a case fully through the system and a final decision. So it's not a fast process by any means. And you know, that's why we think that, you know, having immigration judges who can actually use their expertise to adjudicate cases is such an important part of the solution.
So we have to invest in them, right?
Exactly. And you know, the detail here is that under the Trump administration, they increased immigration judges, but each immigration judge had a set quota. So they had to really rocket through their caseload. Their discretion was limited by decisions that Attorney General Sessions and then Barr made around specific asylum cases. And then I think there was a 40% of asylum judges that were hired by Trump actually had no immigration experience. So these were not individuals who had expertise in immigration law.
And what's that experience like? Now, you're waiting. What happens between your first interview and when you finally go before you get this adjudicated? Where do you go? What do you do? And I know that, you know, Republicans, conservatives, racists tend to demagogue this in terms of, oh, they disappear and kill people. That's kind of the shorthand for what they say.
That is the shorthand. So what happens is that oftentimes an asylum applicant will have family, extended family here in the States. So that person will, in essence, serve as kind of a sponsor. And that's where they'll land for those 2 or 3 years. After a certain amount of time, I think after 6 months, the individual can apply for work authorization. So then they can start to earn a living so that they're not scraping together, you know, pennies to survive. But the thing is that the access to immigration attorneys is so important because the data shows that, you know, over 90% of cases that have access to an immigration attorney, they're going to appear for every single one of their hearings. In fact, it's 97%. So you see that, you know, being able to be in a community, have access to an immigration attorney, just makes that process so much more seamless for everybody involved.
How many immigration attorneys do we have, and how do we increase that number?
I believe that the American Immigration Lawyers Association, which is the immigration bar, that they have about 15,000 members. And that's kind of the range of, you know, your kind of corporate immigration attorneys or your big law firms. They don't do a lot of kind of asylum cases for Central Americans, although to their credit, they do quite a bit of pro bono work. So, you know, I think one of the best things that I know I've seen over the last 10 years in this work is the increase in number of law students who are interested in immigration law because of the stories that we're seeing and hearing almost every single day, whether it's here in the U.S. or anywhere around the world. So we're starting to see an increase. But I got to say for the audience that, you know, if you have a local organization that provides legal services to the immigrant community, they are doing just heroic work day in and day out. And I'm sure that they would really appreciate the support.
That's great. Maria Teresa said that you and she were invited to the White House to brief Jared Kushner during the Trump administration. Is that something you're comfortable talking about?
Yes. So there was a meeting with Jared and then Secretary Nielsen, Kirstjen Nielsen, who was then acting head of DHS, was in the room as well as Miles Taylor, who was her chief of staff. And it was an interesting conversation because Kushner at that point was trying to figure out, is there a way to solve this riddle of children and families appearing at the border? And
what year is this? When is this exactly?
It's probably 2018.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, he was asking questions, but it was clear that, you know, look, it was clear that Stephen Miller was not in the room. And ultimately, he was the one that was going to be, along with Jeff Sessions, really running the show. And I just got the feeling that both Nielsen and Kushner were trying to figure out, is there any way we can get around Stephen Miller? And, you know, that proved to not to be the case.
So that didn't, that wasn't a productive meeting, I'm gathering.
No, it was not a productive meeting. And, yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, we could continue with this. Is there anything that you want to cover that I haven't? This is obviously a complex topic where it involves the, you know, reforming Central America or the northern tier of Central America and Mexico. And by the way, I think you told me that during the trade negotiations with Mexico, and you hinted at this, I think, in this interview, that Trump used the terms of that to have Mexico crack down on Central American refugees.
Right. So over the course of the USMCA negotiations, you saw these flows of migrants from Central America to the US-Mexico border. And Trump, in a very Trump non-subtle way, would pressure President López Obrador of Mexico to clamp down on migration from Central America across the Mexican southern border, or to really lose leverage in the negotiations with USMCA. You know, López Obrador, over the course of the Trump administration, many in Mexico would argue this, is that he did everything he could to bend over backwards to Trump in a way that probably undermined the safety and well-being of Mexican nationals in the U.S., much less, you know, people trying to make it to safety from Central America, you know, across Mexico.
Okay, just another little wrinkle in the evil of Donald Trump. Well, anyway, I think to be continued because I just think that right now, and this is something, of course, the Republicans are just senators are flooding to the border to exploit this, right?
Right, and you know, a funny story on this is that you know you might have seen the video of Ted Cruz. His breathy midnight video of kind of at the shore of the Rio Grande. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
He was standing among Carrizo Cane, leaders along the Texas border. We're talking law enforcement and business. We're talking a number of them are Trump voters, Trump donors. One of their security recommendations to DHS prior to, you know, Trump and today is to get rid of the Carrizo Cane. Because
that's the foliage. That's the those jungly looking thing.
Right. That Cruz was roaming around in. So, you know, you get rid of the Carrizo cane, you keep smugglers out, and you know, Ted Cruz has nowhere to go.
Oh, he always has somewhere to go. He always finds somewhere bad to go. Or somewhere nice like Cancun. Thank you so much. And thank you for you've been doing this for what, 20 years or so?
Yep. Since 2003.
Okay. Well, that's actually only 18.
Yeah.
Okay. I was good at math, but thank you for doing this for 18 years. And you're doing like a wonderful thing. And man, oh man, this is complicated. And man, oh man, I wish Vice President Harris, you know, the best of luck in dealing with this and wisdom. And I hope she talks to you a lot.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Alan. Looking forward to talking more about this. It is a complicated issue, but the one upside of Trump on immigration is that more people than ever are asking questions about the issue. So I just think we need to take advantage of that opportunity to help people understand what's going on and more importantly, what needs to be changed.
Hey, everybody, before you go, before you stop listening, I asked Ali for a number of people who really, really help those people at the border who are coming across the border. And these are groups that I've given to before in El Paso, the Annunciation House, and they house people. Also, Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. In McAllen, Texas, Catholic Charities of the Rio Grande Valley. And in Arizona, Kino Border Initiative. Now, we have links to all of these in the podcast description. So I hope you can help these folks. It's really needed, as you know. And thank you for listening to my podcast. Thank you for your loyalty to that. And this music by Leo Kottke, the brilliant Leo Kottke. Our executive producer, Peter Ogburn, does this with me and is brilliant. And thank you. Thank you for listening. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.